25 a.m. on April 21st. For the record, we have representatives, all the representatives on the Finance Committee except co-chair here right now, and he will be here shortly. Is there anything to come before the committee before we start with the agenda? If not, what my plan is doing here is to take up Senate Bill 133 first. We're going to break, we're going to, at 11 o'clock, we have a conference committee, and the co-chair will take over and take up, at that time, House Bill 114 and SJR 21. We'll set the bill aside until after the conference committee. And maybe that might be a time to break, and let's look at it and see what happens over the weekend and what have you. I'm not tied to anything yet. And as far as the way that we'll go today, we heard from the sponsor, we had public testimony, we discontinued public testimony. We haven't heard from the administration, but what I'd like to do is, and Carl, what I'd like to do is to work on amendments that we have, and then here, and have the administration come up and help us go through these amendments along with the committee. Does that sound like a plan to me, Representative Davies?
I was a little confused. Are we going to have their testimony, their general testimony first?
No.
Why not?
I think what we'll do is, we have probably they'll be talking on amendments. The amendments is probably where all the problems are right now we have with the bill. We have two amendments before us, I believe, and that is the crest of the problems we have, or the differences we have. They can talk during the time at the table on the bill and tie it all together. I want to get a clear story rather than break it up.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that's my concern. I mean, the normal process is to allow them to make the general, so we have the kind of overview of what their general view of the situation is, so we have that context to deal with the specific amendments. I think it would be more efficient, actually, to get a coherent statement first and then to deal with the sub-issues. I mean, actually, I think it would take less time.
That's what I'm trying to get to, is taking less time.
Well, that's what I'm saying, suggesting.
Let's see. I think right now, my, Representative Bundy?
Well, if it compromises, if they could, if the folks from the administration have a couple of minute overview and maybe do the 2 minutes now instead of the 2 minutes during, or the 10 minutes during questions.
All right.
I know it's difficult for the administration to limit the remarks to a couple of minutes, but they're probably capable.
If the administration would like to come up first, and I will give you 2 minutes. Starting now. If...
Slave driver.
2 minutes, it's 25 after.
Good morning, Chairman Williams and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, the Deputy Commissioner of Education. First, I want to applaud the many committees and members of both the House and Senate that have already vested untold time and energy in gaining a comprehensive understanding of the issues facing our students with the high school exit exam. From our perspective, the discussions have thus far been invigorating and most instructive for everyone concerned about Alaska's standards-based reform effort. From the viewpoint of the department, two critical components of our standards-based reform effort require additional consideration. First, Alaska must provide sufficient time for the transition from our old credit-based educational system based on inputs like seat time and units of credits to our new standards-based educational system, based on student results. Broad-based acceptance and early-on successes with our reform effort are critical for long-term gains. From a defensibility standpoint, the legal clock started ticking in the fall of 2000 when schools, school districts, and families learned the results of the first administration of the high school graduation qualifying exam. The high school test and the standards give Alaska a great opportunity to better educate all students to higher levels of performance. So let's not risk it by unnecessarily rushing the high-stakes portion of our reform effort. Instituting high stakes in 2004 may improve our defensibility. Waiting to a later date will both improve our defensibility and, I might add, improve our chances to prevail when the legal challenges come, as well as enhance our state's capacity to ensure that all of our students have the opportunity to learn what is expected. Second, we must ensure that our system of accountability is fair to all concerned. I commend both the Senate and House for already acknowledging that waivers for students entering Alaskan high schools late in their schooling, as well as for students experiencing unusual and unique circumstances, are good public policy and appropriate for these special populations. This refinement allows us to remain true to our commitment that every child will be a winner. Our goal is aimed at creating a system of high standards, assessment, and accountability. To that end, we remain gravely concerned that all special education students, despite unique challenges and differences that these students have with learning, be held to the exact standard without an IEP team's authority to adjust learning targets for appropriately recognized student disabilities. For many of them, it's as if we are predetermining that they will be losers. Should Alaska schools deny students diplomas based on their natural learning difficulties? I think not, for we will unnecessarily be placing stumbling blocks in the future of this group of young people.
If you wrap up, you'll have time to cover some other points here. It's been 3 minutes now.
Okay. At this time, I would like to turn the testimony over to Greg Maloney from the state, who just will review some numbers very quickly for you, if we may, Chairman Williams.
We had 2 minutes for the administration and 2 minutes for Carl. I'd like to do that. Carl?
Chairman. For the record, I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I'm going to try to make the best of this time and focus on the special ed portion. I'm feeling some pressure here, and here's what it is. We have tremendous needs for our funding, and I'm feeling I'm being leveraged behind the principle behind this bill. I'm talking about the special education component. We talked a lot yesterday about the issue of accommodations. You take a look at a special ed student who's identified early, who's given an IEP, say in a second grade, let's consider that to be an accommodation. The word was accommodation yesterday. At the end of the process, should we remove that accommodation by not allowing an IEP to continue through? By federal law, it's a requirement. It's such a requirement that we currently fund special ed by 20%. It's inadequate, and the money comes to be able to fill that requirement, the money comes from regular instruction. And nobody raises a question because it's a federal mandate. We require this federally. So let's look at this as an accommodation. If we use an IEP team as an accommodation for a student early on, why would we remove that at the end of the process when it comes time to be tested? The issue was accommodation, I believe, the day before yesterday. I think this is consistent, and I think it's principally based. And I want to place this issue before you because I feel I'm being leveraged with our funding. Let's separate the issues, get this done right. I really appreciate the work that's been done on this bill for all the reasons that have been mentioned. Now we're starting to get hung up on the special ed portion, and I ask you, I plead with you, to take a look, let's get this done right, based on principle, and the dollars will come based on a need. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, and you'll be here, and we'll ask you back again.
Thank you.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now is go to the bill and go to the amendments and ask the administration to come up and talk. some more on that. We have two amendments before us. Wishes of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bundy.
One of the amendments is an amendment from me, and whatever your pleasure is in whatever order you want to take it. If you're ready, I'd move that amendment and speak to it, or certainly the other amendment from Representative Lancaster is on the table as well.
What's the wishes of the committee? You have any?
Which one is number one and which is two?
They both.
Bundy's
number one.
Lancaster's here. Mr. Chairman, if it makes things simpler, I'll just ask that mine be amendment number one and would move amendment number one.
Amendment number one is moved. Is there objection?
Jeff. And Mr. Chairman, to speak to the amendment, this is a change not in substance, but I think considered substantial, but in I guess technique. What the amendment suggests is the current bill is written, it said that the department will promulgate regulation for the use of waivers for students who enter the system late or for rare and unusual circumstances. And then they will report back to us what they've done after regulations are in place. And what this amendment would suggest is propose the regulations, come back next February, tell us what your proposals are, and allow us then to concur with the proposed regulations. And we may well say, right on, go ahead. Or we might say, well, wait a minute, we feel that public policy suggests it should be tweaked here or there. It seems to be a more, because there is a 2-year delay for any implementation or denial of the diploma, this gives us an opportunity to take a look at these proposed regulations. And as committee members know, certainly this department wouldn't be guilty of it, but there have been departments here who promulgate regulations that don't always reflect as accurately as they could the intent of the legislature. And this gives us an opportunity to take a look at the regulations before they go into effect. Rather than if the regulations should happen to be such that we don't feel they reflect legislative intent, then we'd have to open the bill again and write new law. And it just seemed more efficient. And with that, I'd try to answer questions.
Any questions for the maker of the Representative Croft?
If I could, I'd like to ask the administration a question on this amendment.
Could the three people have talk, please come forward. Carl?
I'm not sure who would be best qualified to answer it, but whoever, go ahead and take a stab at it. Who in this state is the primary population that the waiver language would be affecting? What population are we talking about?
Through the chair, if I may take a stab at that, Representative Croft. I think that it tends to focus in our discussions up to this point around students who arrive in Alaska late in their high school career. That's been one significant population that's been talked about, often in terms of military transfers that might be coming in from other states. That seems to be an issue that is really concerning individuals. The other group that's been talked about, perhaps to a lesser degree, but I think no less important, are immigrant students who might arrive in Alaska in their high school years or middle school years without any capacity with the English language, and how are we going to address that population?
Those are the two that I recall represent the crop.
Any other questions? Representative Harris?
On the section of this amendment that on page 1, line 15, basically, where is insert a competency examination waiver process for students who enter the school system late, for other students with rare and unusual circumstances that merit a waiver. Is it your opinion, any one of the three of you or all three of you, that that would sufficiently deal with military students coming in, say, in the last 3 years or 2 years of their high school years? That could be waived because they obviously haven't gone through Alaska school system for most of their time. Or what would your feeling be that rare and unusual circumstances, would that be a regulation that would be dealt with, or through regulation, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Harris, yeah, I think it ultimately would end up in regulation. Given the time frame for the report, it may well be that the regulations would not be developed by that point in time, but the report would clearly outline what we heard from the general public in terms of what is necessary here, and then we'd move forward to promulgate the regulations from that point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, in the initial bill, which we have in front of us here, where in this bill would it deal with that at this point?
The only thing that will be raised would be
six.
Is it the section that's attempted to be removed?
Through the chair, Representative Harris. Yes, it is page 6. I think it's item number 5.
Okay, so if I may just follow up here one more time, Mr. Chairman. And what in your opinion, is the difference between the amendment that Representative Bundy offered and the removal of Section 5? I'm just trying to get the on record what the differences you might feel.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Harris, if I understand what Representative Bundy's attempting to do with his amendments here is to remove number 5, the department then comes back with the report, the legislature would then have to take proactive legislative action in order to allow this to move forward. The concept of waivers.
Thank you.
Representative Croft, and then...
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, do we have any representative of the military online or here?
Pardon?
Do we have a representative of the military online or here? Besides...
we have Representative Mulder.
Not an elected representative from the military. I mean, somebody who's in the military to speak on this issue. I don't know that we do.
No, we don't.
Okay. Then I'll ask the administration. They may not be as qualified to answer. The concern that I have heard, and that I'd like you to address if you can, is that without some certainty on this issue, it affects military preparedness, because there are military from other states who, if they don't know what the waiver procedures are, or even if they're going to be waiver procedures, have a lot of concerns coming up and moving their kids up with them if there's a test that does not yet have an exception for them, a waiver procedure. And essentially going to this amendment, it delays the implementation of that standard. It provides less certainty in that standard. And so military people who are looking at a transfer to Alaska cannot yet know whether their child is going to receive a high school diploma or be given a chance to receive a high school diploma based on what they know. They're coming up with that sophomore, and they don't yet know and won't know under this until we take action a year or two later. And that's why I asked if there was a military representative, but maybe you could address that concern. Is it real or not?
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Cross. There was a military education summit held in early February that was one of the topics of concern. There is on the part of military families a real concern over the fairness of our exit exam bill in relationship to their own families electing to move to Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I do have a list here I'm taking, and your name is on it, Representative Davies. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr.
Bundy and Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bundy, I do share many of the same concerns with Representative Croft in relation to how we adequately address the needs of the military folks who I have heard from them, as well as from General Schwartz and General Lovelace, that this has caused some consternation to them. And I'm just curious from your perspective, Representative Bundy, how we can adequately address this with the adoption of this amendment. I'm not adverse to it. I just want to be able to be assured that there is consideration in your mind of how we can get there with this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, in response, and I'm next on the list anyway. Certainly, it's my intent, and I think the intent of the legislature, to allow this waiver possibility for people, not only in the military, but someone who goes to work for API or something and comes in the last semester or two, that be addressed. Now, this can be addressed with the waiver, and also in the bill there is a reciprocity clause where if these people come from another state, and there are 24 of them, that have a standards-based system, a competency test, and they've passed the test there, we recognize that and grant reciprocity. So there's that, plus the waiver. Now, I think what we're talking about, and I think I need to correct Representative Croft, they're not a matter of months, and Dr. Johnson can help me. If I understand how they would promulgate the waivers, as they would, or the regulations, they'd go out and the state school board needs to meet, there will be public testimony, there will be a good bit of involvement, which takes time. And they may then be able to, without the amendment, put in place with certainty the regulation in late fall or the winter. I'm asking that they come back with some other reports in February. This is not a nebulous thing to with an uncertain limitation. We will have closure next February, and so it may cost another month or two, but I don't think that's going to threaten our national defense.
Mr. Chairman, in follow-up then, Representative Bundy, if I'm hearing you correct, basically the biggest concern is that the legislature and the public have some certainty about what the regulations are, that we, in fact, are brought in and bought in to the regulations, as opposed to simply delegating that responsibility to the department in relation to waivers, that there's public policy buy-in beyond just the department's adoption. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, certainly. And obviously, I would expect the department to be very successful in this, but they might have left something out, and we're another set of eyes. They may have come up with something that is now regulation and is very difficult to change that the military is unhappy with. And in this time, this gives the military even more opportunity to not only address through the public hearing process, but through the legislative process.
I'd like to hear from the administration. Do you have any comments with what has been said so far?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Bruce Johnson, the Deputy Commissioner of Education. Certainly it could operate the way Representative Bundy outlined. He and I have had some conversations about this. Nothing really can be done over the summer because we don't have an audience. And so early in the fall, I would expect that the board will undertake a committee process of trying to secure input from Alaskans on this issue. They meet quarterly on regulations. So as I indicated to Mr. Bundy, or Representative Bundy, the earliest that I would see the board having even draft regulations for public comment would be December, and in all likelihood it would be March, which then they would have a period of public comment till the next September or early in December of the following year. on most of the comprehensive critical issues that the State Board deals with, they don't simply have a three-month period of public comment. They leave it open frequently for 6 months. And that gives us a chance to talk about it collectively with the board and make adjustments and put it back out for public comment if those are substantial. So I don't see the State Board would rush through this because it's a very significant issue that is weighty. And I would not expect September or December regulations.
Either one of you would like to comment?
Just a brief comment. I would just say that you know, in working with school boards, the issue of governance is to provide oversight. And I would encourage you to exercise that, provide oversight, keep an eye on what the department is doing, but authorize the department to bring you back something. That would be my general suggestion. It's the issue of powers, whether you govern and provide oversight or whether you get involved in the actual decisions as it's being created.
Representative Bundy, do you want to comment at all?
Well, if I understood Dr. Johnson correctly, and I'd like some confirmation on it, that even without the amendment, it would be at least a year before the regulations are in place. With the amendment, we would have a report back and allow the legislature a chance to, bless the report in February. But even without the amendment, you're not going to have regulations, speaking to Representative Croft's concern, for at least a year.
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, as I say, I think it's highly unlikely that we would have anything available for the board meeting in September, which means the earliest that we would have regulations developed would be December. We just don't do things like that during the summer. It's not fair to the Alaskan public. So, however, that time frame unfolds from there, depending upon the amount of testimony, the satisfaction or dissatisfaction would identify when we'd have something hard and fast.
I'm trying to be as fair as I can to the maker of the motion or to the amendment, and I don't want to feel like I'm overlooking anyone here. Representative Davies?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have sort of a twofold question. First, if I could ask of Representative Bundy, is the intent with this, let me just state my concern at the outset, which is that if we don't have in the legislation, in the statutes, the authorization or the request for a waiver process, I have two concerns. One is I want to know what the process intended is. The department really can't start the official process of noticing and doing regulations without the statutory authority. They can have hearings and stuff, but they'll have to go back over and start the clock at the time that we pass the authorizing legislation and go through the public process of doing, and I'm concerned that creates some delay. And then I guess my first question for Representative Bundy is, so is it your intent then that we would come back and revisit the statutes a year from now and adopt that statutory authority for the waiver?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that the legislation or that the legislature would agree with the proposed regulation or ask for some modification in February. And I'd ask Dr. Johnson to respond. I see them beginning the regulatory process with their September meeting. They've already said they won't meet over the summer. They begin the regulatory process with a September meeting. They provide a report to the legislature and continue their regulatory process beyond February. They may, if all the planets align, be ready to implement regulation the day after they give us the report. They may, as Dr. Johnson said, if there's the public, if they feel the public needs additional time, they may continue that process for another 6 months.
Okay. Now, having heard that, then the process, as I'm understanding it, then is that we're sort of suggesting, with legislative intent here, that there might be a waiver process, and on the basis of that suggestion, we're asking the board to go out and do a bunch of hearings and stuff and come back to us with a proposed set of waiver regulations And then subsequent to that, we're going to adopt the authorizing legislation or modify it. It seems, so my question to the administration is, aren't there some statutorily required time frames then involved, once the statute is adopted, to go out and do the adoption of regulations? Don't you have to provide some notice periods and things like that? So what is the time frame starting at the time that we hypothetically adopt some legislation that would authorize it? What is the time frame that's just required for that process to unfold?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, legal counsel just reminded me that if we don't have the statutory authority to develop and place regulations out for public comment, obviously the whole system would be delayed. If you take action in February to proactively adjust the statutes to allow a regulation based on our report, then we would start that process at that point in time, and it's probably in all likelihood the earliest that we would have regulations out for public comment would be June, next June. So I think without the statutory authorization, it would certainly provide some delay.
So, Mr. Chairman, so then if they're out next June, then you talked about perhaps the board normally wanting about a six-month comment period. That means December before the comment period would be closed. And then I guess my concern is, don't we run up against we're putting the time frame out there pretty long, and then we're supposed to adopt this whole thing as having teeth. It seems like that almost demands that we put back the time when we implement the whole competency exam maybe another year. Would you comment on that? I'm asking the administration if they would comment on that.
Through the chair,
on that. Given that at least a year delay in implementing the waiver process, wouldn't that have it bump up against the deadline for implementing the whole high-stakes exam here? Wouldn't you really want another year in that implementation date because of that? That's a question.
Through the chair, Representative Davies, obviously we would prefer additional time. We think that would add to our legal defensibility. I think the situation that you described, the hypothetical situation, is an accurate one. Probably the earliest that the board would take final action on regulations would be that following December, because again, the summer months are not right months for engaging the Alaskan public.
There's considerable discussion about statutory authority. We passed this, and in it, it says competency exam waiver process for students. The department is to create a report back to us. You have statutory authority the day the governor signs this. And you began the process of exploration, if you will, for a waiver. And you should have all that behind you when you report in February. And then you, as I say, if the department chose, and I think the board chooses, things have a way of happening more rapidly if people want them to, the next day they could put those regulations into effect, or they could decide we need 6 months more discussion on this. I mean, you do not have statutory authority to begin this process. If this bill passes with this amendment, it says you will prepare a report on a waiver process.
I think, do you want to answer to that, please?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, I would leave that up to legal interpretation. I think under the scenario you're describing, the report comes back. Even if that report contained proposed regulations, we would then place them out for public comment in March, and the earliest the board would adopt them would be June, assuming that everything worked nicely. But given the weight of this concept, we're rarely successful in 3 months, rarely successful.
Now, if I might, so I'm trying to get the time frame difference, and I want to make sure we're not arguing over angels on the head of the pin. The scenario you described we'd have regulations out for public comment in first of the year, if without the amendment. And then you would adopt them sometime after that. If all worked well with the amendment, you would adopt them in June. So we're still talking about a matter of a few months and not years, I think. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, I think that's a fair characterization. It wouldn't be years, but it would be months. And depending upon the amount of public discourse over this issue, it could be several months.
Thank you.
Is this along the same lines, Representative Hudson?
It deals with the military.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulder and then Representative Hudson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, my interpretation of this discussion, because I share many of the concerns, but I come back to the language. I mean, the language in the bill is what we're really talking about. It says the department shall, by February 15, report back to the legislature with recommendations for, and this amendment says, a competency examination waiver process for students who enter the school system late and other students with rare or unusual circumstances that merit a waiver. If I interpret the thrust of the amendment, it says that we're not going to have, the process is going to be in statute. You're going to recommend to us statutory changes, so that in opposed to regulations, we're going to put it in statute what that process is going to be. And there's a certain amount of security from the legislature standpoint of being certain what they're buying into, as opposed to having to second-guess a regulation. You know, that's my interpretation of this, is that the legislature is going to buy into the waiver as opposed to having the department establish a regulation, and then we can, you know, dance on the head of a pin if we like it or not. But this way, it's certain to buy in the legislature, and we put that process into statute as opposed to regulation.
Would the administration like to comment on that first? Or?
No comment, Representative.
Representative Davies, on this issue?
On this issue, Mr. Chairman. I think that in the first place, I think it's the process that we're describing here is inappropriate. We're inserting the legislature into the regulatory piece of it, where I think that, you know, we really should be setting what we clearly want, having that go out through the normal regulation writing process. So I think, you know, I'm objecting in the first place to that micromanagement kind of approach to dealing with the thing. I think the second thing is that I believe that the fact that the department goes out and has hearings on the basis of a report that they're supposed to write is a wholly different thing than having hearings on the basis of a statutory requirement for a waiver process. And it doesn't meet the usual public process required in implementing regulations. I think that even if we were to put some of those regulations into statute, it's unlikely that we're going to put everything that they need in terms of implementing regulations in place, and that they're still going to have the need to go out through the normal regulatory process no matter what we put in the statutes. And I guess to that end, I think there's somebody here from that understands the law, and I'd like to hear from them on this topic if we could.
Before we get there,
can I ask my question before?
Yes, I'd
before
like
we move on, because it kind of relates to the same thing. This is the first thing that that I think that I have some relevance to, and that is that it looks to me like the military typically issues their orders last winter for people to transfer this summer, and that's ordinarily the way the Coast Guard has always done it. At any rate, we get our orders in October, November, December, and we are instructed to proceed and report by July 1st of the following year. Now, there's hundreds of these families that are literally in motion, and they're already packing their goods and bringing their kids, and they're heading in this direction. And up to this point in time, they've all had some assurance, at any rate, that their high schooler, 10th grader, 9th grader, was going to be able to come up here and fit right into the high school program and graduate in 3 to 4 years by the time they had concluded that tour of duty. I would not want to see any legislation that adversely impacted that flow. And if that means that we have to give the Department of Education and the school systems in Alaska the authority to go ahead and write the regulations that deals with these in-transfer students now, so that assurance could be held and they would have it. That's what I would like to see. If this amendment upsets that, Con, then I want you to tell me how we can give assurance to those transferring in families that we're not going to second guess, or, as is indicated, say micromanage. Not that you'd ever do that, but you know, there's some of us that might like to try to change things around to suit our own particular fancy here. So I need to have assurance before I make my final vote, even on this bill, that nothing is going to negatively impact the transfer in, particularly military and other. You know, there's educators, there's teachers that are coming up here, too, to take jobs up in rural Alaska and things like that. So we're changing the process. Let's make certain that these people are assured that whatever course they're on, they're going to have a legitimate opportunity to pursue and achieve their results. And
thank you. I think it's important to point out, and I'd like to point out for the record, that none of this discussion is really about whether there should be, that there should not be waivers. I agree, I think, for the record, I think the majority, certainly the people I've talked to in this process have agreed that there should be waivers. What we're talking about is the process. Do we, and I'm exempting current participants, do we trust state departments enough to write regulation to accurately reflect what the legislative intent is, or would we rather that they come back to us and say, this is what we propose, and we put it in our statute, is yes, this is, and this is going where we think you ought to be going. Now, I understand your concern about micromanaging, but if they create the regulation, and in spite of all their best efforts, they cause this problem you're worried about, what do we do about it? Well, it's a very cumbersome process then to try to eliminate
the regulations.
And I'm saying this, and I think we're trying to go to the same place, is that we do this in concert rather than say, okay, you go ahead and we'll accept whatever you create.
Now, we do have to go into the conference committee here shortly. What I'd like to do is take one more question from Representative Croft, and then set the amendment aside and come back later this after conference committee and take up the other amendment and discuss that one also. And I will discuss when Representative Senator Green would like to come up and discuss this also at that time. Representative Croft, do you have...
On the procedures, Mr. Chairman, I have a pending request for the lawyer to comment on it, too. Is that still on the list?
Well,
thank you.
I'm trying to get...
I understand. I just want to not forget that.
I won't forget that. Representative Croft.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And with that, we'll just go. I guess in the all the discussion that's come up, the only thing I want to say is Representative Bundy did describe it as a cumbersome process. Our legislative process is one. It's designed to be that way. And so the fundamental question that we're going to come back to on amendment number one is, we want it in place, and the military can tell their people, there's a waiver process in place. Now, the legislature may change it, but it's in place, or they don't have one. They're studying it. And that's a very fundamental difference. If they write it, we can change it. We can use our cumbersome process to then modify it. But do you want it in and we work on fixing it, or out and we work on putting it in? And that's the distinction that we'll come back to on a minute.
Thank you, gentlemen. And we'll be back here hopefully within a half hour. The responses, would you like to say anything right now? Representative Davies?
He didn't hear you. You want me to get him, Billy?
Would you like to now, or when you come back? Or? It's up to you.
Do we have time now?
Yes, we can make time for it. Please come to order. Please come to order, please. Representative Davies. We're going to hear from the sponsor.
I thought it was on the conference.
We will when she's done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lyda Green, Senate District in the Mat-Su Valley. I guess my concern in reading this, and I would like to remind people who are listening and all, that this removes the requirement that the board shall adopt regulations implementing the exam, including the waiver language, and puts it over into the department shall report back to the legislature with recommendations for. And for us to then be able to say that there is a waiver process, and for that matter, an appeal process is just a letter that's going to come back. It does not have the force of law, and that concerns me. I think it's very, very important that the requirement for the waiver be in we go from that. Go through this again.
Any questions for the sponsor? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Like I said, we're going to set this amendment aside at this time. When we return, we'll come back to possibly the other amendment and take that up for a while. And look at it. We'll be going to conference committee at this time. And if you could take up those two bills, I do not intend to pass the one out for 114. I appreciate it.
If you want to hear 114 and SJR 21, if we complete discussion on SJR 21, you'd like to pass that if it's the will of the committee.
It's more than just one.
All right. Does the committee need a 3-minute recess before we go forward? We will stand and recess. Convene the House Finance Committee meeting. It is 11:30. And we have before us HB 114. The co-chairman suggested when he left that he'd like to take testimony on this bill, but was not at this point going to move it from committee. I'll let him be the heavy, not me, Mary. And with that, Representative Capster, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Before you, I have House Bill 114. It is a bill that would make inhalant abuse a violation punishable by a $300 fine, which can be waived if the abuser chooses to go to rehabilitation. Inhalant abuse has been a very big problem, and it's been a problem for quite a while. Not a new problem. And it's not a problem singular to either rural Alaska or Alaska. This is a national epidemic. A survey of eighth graders recently indicated that 19.6% of all eighth graders have tried inhalant abuse. It's a gateway drug, a gateway substance. Many of the people who are in rehabilitation for alcohol and drug abuse say that if they don't have drugs or alcohol available to them, they will go back to inhalant abuse. Inhalant abuse causes severe organ damage and mental damage. It makes people who abuse inhalants somewhat like fetal alcohol syndrome people. It makes you retarded, basically, toward the end of the abuse. And even after the first time, it can either make you retarded after the first huffing experience, or it can kill you. It's a very serious problem that we're facing. We're at a point right now, fortunately, where we are having thanks to Senator Frank Murkowski, having an inhalant abuse treatment facility being built. It's Its grand opening is scheduled for August 31st, and it's being constructed in Bethel, and that will be a statewide facility. Only two inhalant abuse facilities exist nationwide. One is in South Dakota and one is in Texas. And I believe that the one in Texas is primarily a tribal facility for the members of the Kickapoo Nation. Then I think the one in South Dakota is open to everyone, as this one will be. And the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation are going to be operating the facility in Bethel. What this bill does is it gives leverage to public safety officials and even health medical providers and family members to do something for people who are abusing inhalants. Right now, it is not illegal to abuse inhalants in this state. It is illegal in 24 other states, but not in Alaska. And many of the older abusers know this. So, if you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to entertain them now. I also have with me Bob Butkane, who is from the Health and Social Services Juvenile Justice Department, as well as George Buhite. And I'm sorry, Lauren Jones.
Questions for Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a fiscal note attached, and obviously that is a cost. Given that there is that cost, and also given that by treating a problem that undoubtedly has costs associated with it to the state, and assuming that those costs would go down, has consideration been given to cost savings associated with a program of this nature?
I'm glad you asked that, Representative Whitaker, through the chair. Let me look at my notes for a minute. Says one study found that a 19-year-old with a chronic history of inhalant abuse and significant brain or organic damage will cost society $1.4 million over a lifetime of treatment, medical care, social services, law enforcement, and court costs. There are currently a lot of people in our judicial system, in our court system, in our correctional facilities who have had significant damage done to their bodies by inhalant abuse, and it is costing us right now. I do want to mention that when this was passed out of judiciary on Thursday, we did make one change that is quite significant in terms of costs. On page 2, line 3, we changed shall to may, suspend the imposition of a sentence, place the defendant on probation, and require the defendant to successfully complete an inhalant abuse treatment program where available.
I'm sorry, Representative Kaplan. What? Give me the page and line again on the shall to may.
Okay. Representative Croft, page 2, line 3, section D, court may suspend.
Thank you.
And then at the end of that sentence, they added where available. This will result in a significant decrease in the fiscal note.
Well, then I'll turn the gavel back over to Representative Williams. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might follow up, then my concern is that we've established a cost, and yet we know there's a positive effect in terms of cost, given that the program goes into effect. And so, knowing that, we have no basis for determining what that amount might be. Trying to understand the fiscal implications of this bill, it would be most helpful to have an estimate of what that positive effect in a fiscal sense would be, beyond the social positive effect. And at that point, perhaps we could rationalize, from a fiscal viewpoint, adopting a program of this nature. That's not a question, that's a statement, and a request.
I spoke with someone from the department who says it's very hard to assess how much it's going to cost because we don't have any treatment of this nature at this point. So it's hard to assess. If I could call Bob Butkane to testify on this matter, please, Mr. Chairman. Sure. Lauren? As well as Lauren Jones.
Chairman. For the record, my name is Lauren Jones. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services. In response to Representative Whitaker's question about positive effects, I would estimate that the effects that earlier intervention with youth in particular, where they don't repeat the inhalant behavior, the savings there would be to local law enforcement, the savings there would be to hospital costs, especially if the individual had no insurance, or to educational costs, costs that I don't know that I could put a number to. In terms of the potential costs that would be paid out to repair or to mitigate any damage by the person's continued inhalant use. Inhalants is one of the drugs that has some pretty recognized damage effects that can happen even on the first offense. Sniffing gasoline, butane, those kinds of common accessible chemicals can cause pretty severe brain damage the first time. And some of that's not repairable. So there's long-term costs to that individual that if they're uninsured or poor, can't get insurance, those costs then revert back to the rest of us in some ways. But I don't know that I could put a number on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might then just make a further comment, and that is recognizing that it is nebulous, and I think we all do, and it would be a wild guess if you were to insert a number, and I recognize that as well. But I think it would be less than responsible of the committee to not recognize that nebulous as the number may be, it does exist. And as we deliberate this bill, we should take that into consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
Can you give me some idea, thank you, Mr. Chairman, of the costs of, to the state, of taking care of a severely disabled child, with the kind of disabilities that can result from this abuse? I understand it doesn't always, but when it does occur, what kind of costs does the state incur taking care of that person?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, for youth who may or may not have the severe damage if with prolonged inhalant abuse, probably the most comparable place that I would suggest that we could look for those costs would be cost to a person who is developmentally disabled, a youth that has some kind of is medically fragile, somebody who had some kind of organic brain damage at near birth, in terms of what they would need, you know, to be able to relearn to walk or to speak, those kinds of costs. You would look more into development of disabled costs to children. There are very similarities between the kinds of care those individuals would need. Again, I don't know what the average cost is. I think our department probably does, but we can certainly try to get you that information.
Well, even just ballpark, Mr. Chairman, you know, it doesn't have to be exact, but is it in the tens, hundreds of thousands, or I've heard for very severely disabled, you can get up into the hundreds of thousands per year to take care of somebody like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, I don't know, but I can certainly ask our department and find out.
Representative Bundy?
Oh, just on that point, fetal alcohol is a good example. It's $1.4 million in a person's lifetime in round numbers. And if somebody is cognitively impacted by sniffing, you know, they're going to be in that category. I think Representative Capstner used that characterization. My question is, two questions actually. We're doing missions and measures, and certainly I join you in thinking that what a terrible tragedy that people destroy their brains sniffing any substance, destroy the brain of any, or lungs with any substance. But it's mostly young person's addiction, I guess. And I'm wondering, it ought to be illegal, I suppose, but wondering how a $300 fine is going to affect a young person who lives anywhere in Alaska, I guess, with little or no income, and the courts probably wouldn't fine them anyway. On the other end of it, if it's, you mentioned adults who can't get booze or drugs, then they sniff, well, they're that far gone, they probably don't have any money either, so I'm not sure that the $300 fine has any impact. So how do we know when we pass this law that we're doing any good? We know what our mission is. What's our measurement?
Mr. Chairman, when we introduced this bill originally, it was as a violation. In Hess committee last year, we changed that to a Class B misdemeanor so that the abuser would go to jail. And that, while it was a Class B misdemeanor, I got a considerable amount of response from, you know, statewide saying, we don't want to criminalize a 10-year-old kid. We don't want to send a 10-year-old kid to McLaughlin because he tried huffing once. And then you get children into the system and they might not ever get out, especially if there's considerable amount of brain damage. It's hard to go through a juvenile detention treatment program. And so you could potentially have a child in detention for, you know, until they're 18 or 19 years old. Perhaps Mr. Butkane would like to respond to that.
For the record, my name is Robert Butkane. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Juvenile Justice. I draw the committee's attention to Section 4 on page 3. This is a new scheme that we have developed working with the sponsor in trying to find a way to effectively intervene in these inhalant abuse cases without necessarily incurring an obligation to bankrupt the state by responding to the need. What we contemplate here is allowing primarily a peace officer, a village public safety officer, the authority to intervene when they come upon a young person who has been huffing and is found to be intoxicated or incapacitated by inhalants. For example, if you can imagine a village public safety officer coming upon a young person who is next to a snow machine, the gas cap is off, and the kid appears to be intoxicated because he's had his nose in the gas tank. Under current law, there's very little intervention that can be implemented. There's very little authority that the police officer has other than, say, a good Samaritan act to take the kid into custody, but then what do you do with him? What we're doing in Section 4 of this bill is giving that law enforcement officer an opportunity to take custody of the child without effecting an arrest and taking the child to their parent. Once we bring the child to the parent, it is hoped then that the parent will then take responsibility and start another follow-up process or intervention. That could include a referral to treatment for assessment. That might be a medical examination to make sure that the physiological condition of the child is such that the child is physically safe. If no parent is available, there is a process here where that child can be taken to some other appropriate placement. Facility, a medical facility, a treatment facility, and as a last resort, using the mechanisms under the current law that allow a person to go into a holding facility for detoxification. Once they've been released or sobered up, if you will, then this provision also allows that they can be released to a parent, and again, if a parent cannot be found, that they can notify the department and then we can make sure that the child is provided for. In the case of an adult who is found to be involved in inhalant abuse, what we are doing in this bill through the other sections 5 through, I believe, the end of the bill, we are adding the term inhalants to the existing Alcoholism Intoxication Treatment Act provision under Title 4737. So this would allow us mechanisms to do emergency as well as involuntary commitment of adults who have been found to be abusing inhalants. You can do all of this and effect interventions and responses that are appropriate without necessarily criminalizing this act, although making this a violation, again, gives the system an opportunity to both identify and then to intervene, bring the person before an, an entity, which would be the district court, and then the district court could then start helping the person make decisions to get into treatment, to change behaviors, to mitigate the damage that they're causing to themselves and hence society when they are using substances. So we found, I hope, what we believe is this compromise between doing nothing, letting the problem persist, and doing everything where we could bankrupt the state in trying to address this problem because it is so significant and so severe. We've got an opportunity with the treatment program in Bethel to take a next step. That program is funded through federal dollars. It gives the state an opportunity to start another step in understanding the extent of this problem, understanding processes that we need to employ to correct the problem. So again, this bill isn't an end-all. This doesn't solve the problem, but it really is a next step. And I think if we don't take this next step, we perpetuate this problem where village police don't have authorities to take action. Systems don't equip ourselves, our treatment resources and whatnot, don't equip ourselves to more effectively deal with inhalant abusers. I mean, it's an opportunity in this bill to take another step without running the entire race. I don't know really how else to say that, but that's a very long way to answer your question. There are mechanisms to deal with juveniles as well as adults who involve themselves in inhalant abuse through this bill.
We had just received, the committee had just received this bill yesterday and with the fiscal note and what have you. What I'd like to do at this time, Representative Kapsner, is to hold this bill and have the committee or the committee aide work with you on this to see how we can better understand it and make it workable for the committee. So what I'll do at this time is set it aside and we'll bring it up hopefully before the end of session.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, can you give me any indication of what areas you'd like me to work on? Would you like me to just try to provide a fiscal
like
note?
Like I said, we just received this bill yesterday.
Okay.
And I'm not really, Representative Hudson?
Maybe it will help, Mr. Chairman. Mary, I've heard a lot about this, but I don't know the specifics, and it looks to me like we have one facility in Bethel that is coming up, and I'm still not certain of how we treat people who are huffing in Southeast and up in Anchorage and Fairbanks and places like that. And so when you come back, maybe you could give us an idea of how I understand the legislation is essentially providing public safety people the tools in order to intercede or to inject themselves into somebody else's bad habits and hopefully save their life. So just when you come back, maybe you could just give us an idea of how you see the whole process working. How's the flow, the process? It would help.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder also too if the department could check with the two facilities there in Texas and North Dakota, wherever, and see what those costs could be that Representative Whitaker was asking about. Be helpful.
But we will be working with your office on this, and hopefully we can come up with something that we can get through the legislature. And it is a very important bill, and it is another step that has to be taken. I agree with you. And,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Did you get to the...
No, I didn't. I don't know, for just according to Hoyle here, you had an amendment on the table when, and I sort of just launched into another bill. I would probably should have withdrawn that amendment, but I guess it's still on the table now.
If you wanted
to address that, I want to try to bring it to closure and stop taking any more of the committee time on that amendment.
On the
133.
Yeah, what I plan on doing with 133 is coming back after we finish this resolution, with Senate resolution, and
you know, just for doing it properly, maybe I should remove my motion on amendment number one for 133 so that we
so we can
we have a clear calendar here.
What I'd like to
and
do
I would
is,
do that, Mr.
I'd Chairman. Like to set that aside and then
so I've withdrawn my amendment number one to Senate Bill 33 so that we can address other business, and then I reinstate it when we come back.
Okay, thank you, sir. We'll take up committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 21. Sponsor is, representative is here.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm staff to Senator Lyda Green. SGR 21 is simply a resolution that urges the United States Congress to extend the authorization date for supplemental block grants to the state of Alaska under the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And this resolution, the Representative Harris offered a companion resolution in the House. What this does is it fills a what would otherwise be a $7 million gap in next year's budget if Congress fails to reauthorize this program for the next year. Any questions?
Any questions for the sponsor? Representative Harris?
Just to echo my support for this, and it's just an appeal to the Congress to continue the authorization of this. It's without it, it's going to cost the state, it's either going to cost the state or just money that the state won't get of almost $7 million.
Thank you. There's no questions for the sponsor. What's the wish of the committee?
Chairman,
Representative Harris.
Move SGR 21 out of committee with individual recommendations. Attached zero fiscal vote.
Heard the motion. Is there any objection? Not so ordered. Next, we will go back to 133. And again, Representative Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move amendment number one and just speak briefly to it.
Okay. What I'd like to do is be to at least have the administration here.
Well, I'm just going to call for the question.
Pardon?
I just want to have a vote on it. I think we've discussed it enough.
It's my intent. I would like to be able to at least hold an amendment and then, you know, maybe Tuesday of next week we can.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just rather vote on the amendment. I don't think it's that complicated, and let's, you know, I don't need to take any more committee time. I think Representative Croft characterized it accurately. Do you trust the department and the state board to write regulations that will accomplish what we want to accomplish in regulations, or would you rather review them before they go into effect? I think it's fair to say that probably Representative Croft trusts the department and the state board more than I do. And so I'm being cautious, but I don't need to know that we need to discuss it anymore. I'd say let's just vote on it.
Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there's that one issue that has to do with, you know, do you trust them or not. There's the other issue, I think, of the timing, and I think that we do need to have the waiver process in the statute so that we can get the process going sooner rather than later, and that's the other major issue that I'm concerned about. Mr. Chairman, we haven't had the testimony from Phil Reeves yet on that topic.
I'm going to call a recess for a few minutes until we get the people in.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bundy.
I'd like to withdraw amendment number one and replace it with a Croft-Bundy modified amendment number one.
Okay.
And I think we can do this at the table if the committee, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If the committee would look at page 6, line 14, and simply delete the language after the word waiver. So the end of the amendment would add, would the last four words of item number 5 would say circumstances meriting a waiver, period. What would be removed would be that the words and must require that a student satisfy the performance standards developed under AS 14.07.020B to the maximum extent possible.
You've heard that motion. If we could just Representative Croft speak to the motion, please.
Yeah, since it's sort of a joint motion, I'd just like to put on the record real quick, Mr. Chairman, appreciate working with Representative Bundy on it. It was his concern, and once he explained it, mine, that that could be interpreted as a blanket authority to get into either the special needs area, the alternative assessment area, or a blanket authority in the entire thing. I think these waivers should be either for, as it states above, either for late entrance or rare and unusual circumstances. There's a fair amount of room under that already, and he's more comfortable with that. I think it clarifies it. And just wanted to put those concerns, it's not my intent, and I know it's not his, that be an open license to have wholesale, some might say, dumbing down of the process or entry through the waiver into the IEP area.
Senator Green, did you care to have you or your staff member speak to that?
No, I don't think so.
You object to that?
I'm not sure.
I don't have the statute reference of 14.07.02B, and I assume that's special ed.
Would you like the administration to come up and...
Probably would be better. I'm not prepared to speak to that because I don't have my statutes
Can
here.
Can someone in the administration come forward, please? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, did Representative Bundy, did you withdraw amendment number 1 in total? And then this is a new amendment number 1.
I was just trying to figure out what that reference was to, and I don't know what it's to in the first place. Well, this is just a performance standards. Okay, I see. That's fine. Thank you. No, that's fine.
No objections?
No, sir. No, thank you.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objections? If not, so ordered. We'll take up amendment number 2, and hopefully we will work this something similar to what we did the last time. If not, what I'd like to do is at least have the person that is discussing the issue discuss it with both Representative Bundy and the administration. I'd like to handle one issue at a time and not jump all over. So, Representative Lancaster, if you'd like to move your amendment.
I'd move amendment number 2, Chairman.
I object.
This objection, I'd like to have the administration, and if the sponsor would like to come up also, it'd be fine. Is anyone in administration that... Do you wish to speak to the amendment, or
Representative Williams and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Johnson, the Deputy Commissioner of Education. These are amendments that we're familiar with as a result of earlier committee work. They are supported by the Department of Education, particularly in regard to our effort to treat children with disabilities in a fair and appropriate manner, and we believe that these amendments would accomplish that.
Representative Croft, do you have a question?
I have a question on the impact of this amendment. This is a complex area with a lot of different legal standards. I'm trying to get it into my own head on practical examples. I wonder if the department can tell me under a blind student who wants to use Braille for the test, is that considered now an accommodation or a modification?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that is an accommodation and is permissible.
And if
it's permissible by, according to who?
By the local district, and we provide guidelines to local school districts regarding that in a document called Participation Guidelines.
So under sort of either version, with or without the amendment, that would be an accommodation and allowed?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that's correct.
And if I could follow that just a little more, because it helps me to understand with a concrete example. If I'm a modern blind person, if you will, and used to a computer reader and maybe software that speaks out the text so that I type it in and I hear it back and I can know whether what I typed is correct. And I ask to be read the text because I'm used to hearing. That's the way I function. I listen to my emails. And the accommodation or modification that's requested is read me the test, the reading part. Is that an accommodation or a modification?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, we do allow as an appropriate accommodation the reading of the math and writing test, but not the reading test, because that then changes the playing field and the scope of what we're trying to accomplish with our reading exam.
And is there a difference in those results between the bill as it stands and what we'll be doing under Amendment Number 2?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I believe that without Amendment 2, we'll be in a position where we have to come back and ask the legislature, based on our findings and reports, to amend the statute, which would allow children with disabilities to receive a diploma if, in fact, their IEP team determines that modifications are necessary.
It wouldn't meet. Just to come on that issue so I can get it nailed down, and then we can go on to whatever else. It wouldn't meet because in the bill where it says on page 3, a child, line 11, a child with a disability, and essentially either passes the exam, passes it with accommodations, and that's what we were talking about is accommodations, or demonstrates mastery of the state standards, which is reading there and wouldn't get, there's no way under either of those three for that hypothetical blind person who communicates using high technology but basically through sound and speech to get a diploma.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I think you're on target that if in fact it slipped over into a modification and the reading exam was being read to the student, then it would become a modification. As I understand Representative Bundy's interpretation of item C, what he's asking there is that children with disabilities must meet the exact same standards, performance standards, of any other child.
Mastery of state performance.
That's right. And it's exact. You can't adjust it for them.
And under the amendment, if we adopt Amendment 2, that student would receive a diploma if they passed the math and writing, with maybe the accommodation of somebody reading the math part to them, but it might not have the reading endorsement on it.
Through the chair, Representative Krupp. Yes, that another portion of the amendment that's before you would institute the endorsement concept. So you're correct that if you pass two of the exams, even though there may have been approved modifications, you would get that endorsement on your diploma. But if the reading test was read to the student, then that endorsement would be missing.
Yeah, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bundy.
Yeah. I'm not sure that that's what you meant, but what I heard was that the committee substitute would not allow accommodations for special ed, and that is not correct. The committee substitute says very clearly that a student who has an IEP can use accommodations. What the amendment, and correct me if I'm wrong, what the amendment, even though it calls it an alternative assessment, is speaking to is modifications. The amendment says that we'll modify the test to accommodate the student, and as we had testimony the other day, if that means the passing level is a third grade level, that would be acceptable.
Through the chair, Representative Bundy, yes, it would be that type of modification. Would be permitted.
Just a correction. I'm sure you did it to simplify, but you mentioned Representative Bundy's concern. I just handed out something from a special ed parent this morning. It is the special ed parent's concern about this amendment that would create an IEP diploma. I don't know that it's my concern as much as it is that many special needs parents, or parents of special needs kids, are very concerned about an IEP diploma, and this could create that.
Representative Senator Green?
Yeah, well, I continue to hear various references about IEP diplomas and the great variety of number of tests we're going to be providing for children. The department has been authorized to contract for the construction of one test. That is the test that will be given to probably 89% to 90% of the students in the state of Alaska. We have a very small minority of students, less than 11%, over which this entire conversation is being expended. These students have a variety of learning disabilities, developmental disabilities, and burdens that they've dealt with from birth, many of them. I am very concerned that we continue to focus on what we can do to make their life more difficult in the senior year that they're supposed to graduate. The language here says we are concerned with an appropriate method by which students are tested on the knowledge they have. And the method by which they give that information back may be a little different. But if we're concerned about whether or not they have learned the information and can leave our system with the preparation to go out in life and live, we've done our job. And to make that narrow, and perhaps, for instance, in line 1920 on page 3, that when we talk about the portfolio, for instance, the portfolio is one of many methods by which an IEP team may wish to assess a student. Why we would pick that one and say you're not going to be able to use all the other dozens of methods by which you teach, instruct, assess these students every day of their life. So if we get to the end game and we suddenly say, oh, we can't use all of those, we're going to go back to this narrow focus that is actually designed for that other 89%. As a parent, as a former student, as a teacher of short tenure, but of a teacher of 8 years of tutoring students who fall within this category, I'm baffled that we're going to try to do something that inhibits the successful completion of their high school career. I don't know. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Johnson, you care to comment?
Yes, through the chair and Representative Bundy, I I don't believe that what we're creating here is an IEP diploma. When you look at the amendments that are before us here, if anything, with the endorsement concept, what's being created here are differentiated diplomas, which will have meaning to them over time.
We have several here. We have Representative Whitaker, Hudson, Davies, and Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns that I've heard voiced is related to the denigration of value of a diploma for the 90% if there is no differentiation in diplomas. Can you address that and tell me how we can alleviate that concern, or if it even is a concern in your mind?
I will do this. I'll attempt. I'm not sure that I can answer your question because I think these men are far more qualified than I to do that. But, I'm not sure. I know in the Senate discussion, and I'll go back to that because that's what I'm more familiar with, and it may well be the same in this. It was our intention that every student except the severely disabled take the full and complete exam first go around. For a variety of reasons, to be able to assess students, to be able to assess special education, to be able to assess school districts. Are we on the right track as we work with students who've been, who've been under an IEP for many years, some of whom may not have been till 7th grade, some others till not until 10th grade, to find out how we're doing in bringing them up to the level of work of that regularly mainstreamed child. So for one thing, this was an information gathering system. And then, and I may be wrong about this because I think Greg Maloney, oh, he's not here, I think he will tell you that the full and complete exam for a student on an IEP is the original exam with accommodations. If I had my way, I would have every student take the original, the total exam, first go around. Find out what we're doing, where the gaps are, what do we need to be doing better, and then come back and allow the student to do it with accommodations according to the level allowed under the IEP. And that's the full, probably 98% of the students who are going to do that. Severely disabled, who will never...